You're listening to The Warblers, a Birds Canada podcast. I'm Andrea Garas.
And I am Andres Jimenez.
Join us as we travel on common flight paths with our guests, gaining insight and inspiration from the world of birds and bird conservation in Canada. On this episode, we're going to be talking about common loons, and are they as common as we think they are? We'll chat with Kristen Bianchini, who's done a lot of really heavy-hitting, interesting research on the population and the threats that they face. And we'll also chat with Kathy Jones, who leads the Canadian Lakes Loon Survey for Birds Canada, a project that's been ongoing for 40 years and has taught us so much about these birds. Both have such incredible insights into these birds and into how we can help them. Between the two of them, we've got a lot to learn and a lot of really great insights. So looking forward to sharing this episode with you.
Hello, Andrea. How are you?
I'm good. How are you doing?
I'm doing good. I want to know, what does this make you think of? Get ready. Did you hear that?
Oh, yeah. That's like instant bliss. Like, can picture sitting on a lake somewhere up north. The sun is just setting and off in the distance, there's a loon.
I think that's a good description for our episode today. It's going to be instant bliss. We're going to be talking about loons and the world they live in and what we can do to help our loon neighbors.
We're chatting with Kathy today. She's the coordinator of Birds Canada's Canadian Lakes Loon Survey and the volunteer manager for our Ontario programs. She's based out of Port Rowan, Ontario. Whenever I was in the office with her, we'd always debate about which is cuter, a piping plover or a loon. And I think there's an obvious answer. We'll chat with her today. She'll tell us a bit more about the Lakes Loon Survey and about how wonderful loons are overall. So Kathy, how would you describe a loon to someone that's never seen one?
Oh, that's so very difficult because it's on our money. I guess if they're in Canada, I tell them, reach into your pocket and pull out a loonie and take a look at the loon on the bird on the coin. But so many of us don't even use classic money anymore. That doesn't work anymore. I would say a loon is a fairly large bird, quite elegant on the breeding grounds, being a beautiful black and gray bird with a red eye and a lovely white necklace with white square blotches on their back.
Okay. Personally, when I think of loons, I picture not so much what they look like, but I picture, you know, sitting out on a lake in the peak of summer and I hear that call off in the distance. Do you find that the sound, like describing sounds of loons, can evoke an image for people?
Oh, I'm sure it does. That wonderful wail that you hear first thing in the morning or late at night. And then you get this idea of it associated with that classic quietness of being on the lake in the early morning. And that itself is such a part of Canada and part of being vacationing on a Canadian lake.
Absolutely. Is that why we find them so captivating, or is there some other reason that loons are so captivating to the general public?
I think we associate them with the places we love. They have an affinity to a specific lake, a pair does. So I think people see them through the years and they think that they have ownership. They see, this is the loon from my lake. This is the pair that I've known and grown up with. And we always have these loons here, and my children will watch these loons raise chicks. And the fact that their time on the lake is very similar to ours, because they hatch the young right around Canada Day weekend, and they are there throughout your entire summer with those young, and they leave the lake in October when most of us close up the cottage.
So, Kathy, are you telling us that loons are like our neighbors, that we see their kids grow up and we kind of play together in the same places?
That is an excellent image. Yes, I agree. That pretty much is how I think a lot of Canadians feel about loons on their lakes.
On that sense, Kathy, how would a loon describe their neighborhood?
They are very much a tourist to their breeding lakes in some ways. They spend half their life on a freshwater lake and half their life in the oceans. So they like to have different homes, a summer home and a winter home. On their summer home, they would choose an area where they have a large expanse of open water with lots of fish, but also with a lot of little bays and nooks and crannies where they can find a nice spot to have a home and a nice, safe, quiet area to raise their young. You'll find that they love neighborhoods with a lot of bays and islands and lots of wetlands, but at the same time, there's open areas of water on the lake as well.
Honestly, it sounds like they just know how to pick a beautiful spot to spend the summer. Are there specific traits that a loon raccoon absolutely must have when they're picking a breeding habitat?
There is, yes. Of course, they have to have a place for the nest. And loons are a little bit different because they don't walk. So they have to have a nest that is very, very close to water. So this really decides the real estate that they choose. They want something that's about 6 inches above the water. It can float, so it could be a floating vegetation mat, or it could be a shoreline or an island that's surrounded by vegetation. It needs to be fairly safe from mammalian predators, so islands are very popular. It needs to be fairly safe from wave action, so having a quiet bay or a place where you're not going to get a lot of waves from wind action is also important.
It's quite interesting. So you've got to find a spot that's safe from the predators, and mm-hmm. it's got to be quiet. So waves from storms and whatnot, but also from boats would be an issue, correct?
Yes, and water level fluctuations, because like, they can only handle water that goes up 6 inches or goes down 12 inches because they can't walk. If you have a lake that, for example, suddenly has masses of water coming in June, because they pretty much usually nest during the month of June, sometimes earlier, sometimes a little later. If they have massive changes in water around June, or they're going to lose the nest. It's going to be flooded out. Or if the water drops really, really low, which is a risk this year, because we have, in Ontario at least, quite a drought, they might have to abandon the nest because they can no longer get into it.
I'm finding fascinating that you're describing that loons are like quintessential Canadian snowbirds with, you know, their cottage, and then they also like to spend time on the beach, and they need this quiet little corner on a lake. But what do you mean that they can't walk?
Well, they're designed for swimming, right? So their legs are very, very far back in the body, and they're an incredibly heavy bird for their size. So they, when they get on land, they kind of shuffle with their wings and their feet pushing them. They can't stand up straight. They can't hold the body on their legs without considerable support from their tail and their back. They're just not designed to be on land at all.
That is incredibly fascinating. Something that really stuck with me is you saying that they might be nesting in new spots this year. How are you going to find that out? Do you have people looking for them?
Honestly, we don't ask people to look for the nests. We have well over 500 volunteers a year, and we really don't want them wandering around shorelines disturbing nests. But they're also such an obvious species on the lake because of the size and the coloration. We ask them to find the territory. And if the loons are on territory, we work on the assumption that there's a nest in there, and it's a pretty safe bet. They don't hold the territories if they don't have a nesting location. And so if we know the species is on territory, we accept that there's a nest there somewhere.
Do you have a greater need for more volunteers this year because of potentially shifting territory?
Not necessarily. We do. It's a long-term program, and they go through this every so many years. Like, droughts happen, high water levels happen, and because it's a long-term program, those changes are kind of built into the way the trends look. But we always need new volunteers because volunteers change and they move. They sell the cottage to the new generation, and we have a lot of lakes in Canada. So to get good coverage of Canada, we just need a lot of people.
Yeah, absolutely. You're coordinating the Canadian Lakes Loon Survey. But
yes.
Tell us a bit more. Tell us more about what that survey actually entails.
Well, the survey is really fun. It's designed for people who spend a lot of time on a specific lake. It was specifically designed this way from the beginning. It has a foundation in solid science in the fact it was designed based on the North American Loon Foundation information so that the data collected similar to what's collected throughout North America on loons. And so we asked people to go out and find loons on territory in June, starting about May 24th is when they start, but usually June's a big time. Then they go back out very early July to see if chicks hatch. And that's actually the most difficult observations to get. And then in August, they go back out to see if the chicks are at least 6 weeks old. 6 week old chicks have traditionally been considered the age in which the chicks will survive and fledge off the lake in the fall. So if volunteers see 6 week old chicks, that tells us how successful the pair were. And we divide the number of 6 week old chicks in Canada by the number of pairs in Canada, and we go that way.
Okay, and what kind of success rate are you looking for there?
To maintain the population level, be it in a small region or throughout Canada, you want to have 0.48 chicks per pair or chicks per territory per year. So let me repeat that a bit clearer. 0.48 chicks per territory per year.
We'll be right back.
The Warblers is supported by Feather Friendly. Birds can't see glass, and millions die each year because of window collisions. You can save dozens of birds by treating your windows with Feather Friendly's do-it-yourself kit or their commercial solution for large projects. The markers are easy to apply and they work. You can also double your impact by using the code BIRDSCANADA, and Feather Friendly will make a donation to support bird conservation. Keep birds singing, treat your windows with Feather Friendly. Visit featherfriendly.com.
So, Christine, can you please tell us how reproductive success and population growth are linked?
The reproductive success is, in loons, it's measured as the number of chicks that make it to at least 6 weeks of age. Because at 6 weeks of age, a chick is about two-thirds the size of an adult loon. And so at that point, it's a big enough size that it can survive. It's not really vulnerable to predators. And so it's really likely that it will survive and migrate south for the winter and then come back a few years later in the summer to breed as well. So reproductive success is kind of a measure of how many adult loons you'll have in the future.
So we can conclude that even though the loon population doesn't seem to be decreasing, having an effect on the reproductive rates of these loons means that we might have a crash later on.
Yeah, and it's also important to remember that loons are really long-lived birds. So a lot of loons will live to be 20 or over 30 years old. And so we might not see decreases in the number of loon adults for decades, even if their chick numbers are decreasing.
On that sense, Kristen, what is the most productive lay or pair you can remember? How many chicks would you say vary productive pair is or has?
That's a good question. So per year, loons will only produce up to two chicks, and it's really rare that they produce more than that. But I remember reading a story out of Wisconsin where they found that a loon pair had been returning to the same lake for, I think it was over 30 years, and they'd produced chicks almost every year for 30 years. So you can imagine that's a lot of chicks adding up over time.
That is a lot of loons.
Mm-hmm.
That is Kristen Bianchini, who has a PhD in toxicology from the University of Saskatchewan. For the past 2 years, Kristen worked as a postdoctoral researcher with Birds Canada, where she completed the research on common loons she is talking about. Can you give us a plain yet fascinating summary of what you found in your most recent article about loons?
Sure. So my research basically had two goals. The first one was to see if the number of chicks that loons are producing have changed over time in Ontario. And the second goal was to look at different factors that are influencing the number of chicks that loons produce. So I looked at a massive amount of loon monitoring data. I analyzed 38 years of data from over 1,500 lakes. And these were all data that were collected by citizen scientists participating in the Canadian Lakes Loon Survey. And so we found that common loons in Ontario are producing fewer and fewer chicks since the early 1980s. So back then, they raised just over 0.8 chicks per pair per year, but now they raise a little bit less than 0.6 chicks per pair per year. So it might not sound like a huge decrease, but other studies have found that if the rate of chick production falls below 0.48 chicks per pair per year, then the population will start to fall apart. So our study shows that Ontario may be on its way to dipping below that 0.48 threshold. We also found that the declines in loon chicks are probably a result from a complex interplay between damage from acid rain and mercury pollution and climate change.
You mentioned Ontario specifically, but do you know what the loon populations are doing in the rest of Canada?
Overall, it's not good. We looked at some of the other provinces just to see if there were similar kind of trends going on. And the only province where there weren't declines was Quebec.
Do you venture a guess as to why that would be?
I would have to guess that it's similar to what's happening in Ontario, because all of these factors like acid rain and mercury and climate change are happening all across Canada. We only used data from Ontario because it had the longest data set. So it went back all the way to the 1980s. But all of these factors that we found in Ontario could be affecting loons across the country.
So, Christine, this world in which loons live sounds to me incredibly complex, with interactions between the weather, the loons, the lakes, the chemicals within those lakes that have their own cycles. And so not only is it very complex, but it's also very fragile, or it seems to be fragile. Kristen, you mentioned mercury and acidity being drivers of chick success decline. Where is the mercury and acidity coming from?
So both of them are pretty much caused by fossil fuel emissions. So when fossil fuel is burned, it releases different compounds into the atmosphere. And some of those compounds turn into acids in the atmosphere that eventually fall as acid rain and then get into lakes and cause them to become acidic. And the same thing is true of mercury, where fossil fuel combustion releases mercury into the atmosphere that eventually travels into different lakes.
How does acid lakes and mercury in the water affect loons' capacity to raise chicks?
So the acid water itself can be toxic to fish, and it also releases a lot of metals that are toxic to fish. So it's the metals and the acid together that decrease fish populations in lakes. Or because loons normally feed on fish, that means that they don't have enough of the food that they need to survive. And then mercury is a neurotoxin. So high mercury levels in lakes will cause loon adults to be more lethargic, so they don't take as good of care of their chicks. And then it also changes chick behavior so that they don't have a lot of the behaviors that help with their survival. So acid and mercury separately affect loons in their own way. And then acidity can also increase the amount of mercury in a lake. For mercury to enter into the food chain, it needs to be converted into methylmercury. This happens more quickly when lakes are more acidic. And so on more acidic lakes, you get more methylmercury production and more mercury entering into the food chain and eventually reaching higher levels and getting into loons.
Okay, let's pause for a sec. That's actually a lot to digest. So essentially, the fossil fuels resulted in higher acidity and mercury levels in our lakes, which reduced fish populations, so there's less food for the loons. But then the mercury is also causing a sort of mercury poisoning in the loon adults and chicks, which reduces their survival skills and further impacts their population.
How does climate change affect loons, taking this too into account?
Yes, so climate change has a lot of different effects for loons. There's research showing that climate change is causing lakes to become more acidic, and it's also causing lakes to have higher mercury levels. And so just the combination of these three things, so climate change, mercury, and acidity, is all kind of working together to decrease loon chick production.
These three factors sound incredibly complicated to deal with. How is it that we can recover these lakes?
Yeah, so that's pretty complicated. So there have already been a lot of programs to decrease the levels of acid rain and mercury emissions. But the problem is that a lot of lakes that became acidic because of acid rain aren't really recovering from that acid rain, even though the amount of acid precipitation has decreased. And the same is true of mercury. Even though mercury emissions have decreased in North America, any mercury that has entered into the environment just sticks around there for a long time. So it's just taking these lakes a really long time to recover.
So this means that there will be a lag and that the lakes will not recover as fast as we want them or need them to.
Exactly.
Kristen, what are the drivers helping loons?
Yeah, so our study mostly looked at what was hurting loons, but we did find that lake size is a good measure for loon productivity. So lakes that are bigger, they tend to have a higher buffering capacity, which means that they're better at staying at a neutral pH and aren't as likely to become acidic. And they also have more fish. And so bigger lakes tend to have better habitat for loons. And they also provide kind of more nesting areas. So there's more shorelines and islands for loons to avoid things like human disturbance or predators.
So a big lake has a lot of fish and can tackle acidity better than smaller lakes. What does your study suggest regarding the speculated harm cormorants and bald eagles produce to loons?
So bald eagles, there have been reports that they depredate loon eggs, chicks, and even adults. And then cormorants are hypothesized to harm local fish populations and to damage nesting habitats. But we actually found that on lakes where there are cormorants and bald eagles, loons actually produce more chicks. So they're not actually having a negative effect at all. And we think that this is because lakes with a lot of bald eagles and cormorants are usually lakes with a lot of fish. So if it's good habitat for the eagles and the cormorants, it's also really good habitat for loons.
What about motorboats and human activity?
Yeah, so we did look at boating activity and shoreline development. So we know that boating activity is bad for loons because any kind of wakes that boats produce can wash out loon nests. And boats can also collide with loons and cause loon deaths, or they can separate loon adults from their chicks. And then shoreline development is a problem because loons nest along lake shorelines. And so any development of a shoreline decreases the amount of habitat available for loons. But for our study, we looked at productivity as a response. So it's the number of chicks per pair per year. And we actually found that there was no relationship between productivity and boating activity and shoreline development. But we think that this is because loons probably are avoiding lakes with a lot of human activity because it's not very good habitat for them. So even though our study didn't show a relationship, we know from other research that these are really big problems for loons.
Yeah, it sounds like your study says, and correct me if I'm wrong, that if we create the conditions for loons to raise a family, our own family will have more and better places to swim, fish, and paddle.
Yeah, that's a really good way of putting it. So any lake that's healthy for loons and is good for loon families is also a place that people can enjoy.
Why are common loons great ecosystems? ecosystem indicators?
Loons are at the top of a lake's food chain. So any kind of changes that affect lower levels in a food chain, like decreases in the number of fish or increasing contaminant levels, all affect loons. And so they're really good measurements of a lake's ecology and of how healthy a lake is.
So what you're telling me is that if a lake had loons and then it doesn't have loons, it's a bad sign.
Yeah. So it could mean that something is going on in the lake that is affecting the health of the lake lower down on the food chain, and that's kind of moved up to affect loons.
So Kristen, I want to know more about your field work. It sounds like you were, you know, trekking into some really remote areas and camping out by the lake and then maybe paddling out onto the water. What did that entail?
Yeah, it was really great. You know, sometimes we wouldn't see anybody at all. We'd be in the middle of nowhere. But we also got to interact with a lot of locals who were kind of interested in the work that we were doing.
That's great. I love running into locals in a spot like that. So I bet you were, you know, you'd be chatting with them about what you're doing. And did they have any interesting stories to share about loons?
Yeah, the really great thing is that everybody was really excited about loons. So it was great to see that people were just really interested in the work that we were doing and had a lot of enthusiasm for loons. I mean, a lot of locals kind of took ownership of the loons on their lake, where like those were their loons that they would see every year and they'd keep track of whether they were producing chicks or not. So people were really enthusiastic about the work that we were doing.
Did you run into any crazy field struggles? Like, did you get your ATVs stuck or anything like that?
Yeah, actually, on our 13th last lake, so we had 13 lakes left, and this was the 13th last one, we got our Jeep stuck on the side of the road. So it was kind of just a sandy embankment, and our Jeep just slid down it very slowly and got very stuck. And of course, we were in the middle of nowhere with no cell phone reception and no radio even. So we just had to kind of flag down people who were driving by, who were like really nice and brought us to the next town so that we could have access to a phone and call for help.
Oh, incredible. And like classic example of local hospitality and how friendly people are in remote areas. Like,
oh,
absolutely
for sure.
Love it.
How do you get 38 years of data from 1,500 lakes?
It's all from the Canadian Lakes Loon Survey. So that's a citizen science program run by Birds Canada. And they've been collecting data in Ontario since 1981. And it's over 2,000 citizen scientists have been collecting data on these lakes for almost 40 years.
The Warblers is a podcast of Birds Canada. Our goal is to bring you the information you need to discover, enjoy, and protect birds. If you like what you hear, please subscribe, leave a review, and share this podcast with everyone you know. Birds Canada relies on the support of donors like you. To learn more or to make a donation, visit birdscanada.org. And if you give, please note the podcast in the comment box.
Let's go back to Kathy Jones, who supports and works with these dedicated volunteers. So, Kathy, loons keep us together, allow us to talk among each other. And for this particular study that uncovered declining reproductive rates on loons, what was the role for citizen science here? How many people had to participate to gather this data? And would it be possible to do it without them?
No, absolutely not. Just close your eyes and visualize the size of Canada. And visualize that Canada has over 1 million lakes. And from there, you just think about how many loons are split up as little individual couples all through that lake environment. Getting out there for 3 snapshots a summer of all those loons couldn't be done without a lot of people. And we've averaged 600 to 1,000 people a year for 40 years. It could not have been collected without community members and lake association members. They made this data possible.
Kathy, the research we're talking about today collects a lot of information through the survey. How does a survey participant look like, an average participant for the Lake Loon Survey?
I think there's a lot of variety in the average participant, and it's cross-Canada variety as well. So in Ontario, for example, there's probably somebody who fishes or cottages at the same lake every year, has a chance to go out there multiple times during the summer and watch the loons. So they quite likely are not going out there specifically to see loons, but because they're there anyways, counts them. Or they could be someone like we have volunteers in BC who love to do backcountry hiking, and they will go and have a favorite traditional trail that they like to hike along, and they will take their binoculars with them and visit 5 or 10 lakes that week and count loons on those smaller lakes on each visit. Or somebody, for example, in Atlantic Canada or Newfoundland who has a favorite hunting camp, and as their family goes to that hunting camp during the summer and the fall to fish and hunt, they will do the same thing. They will count the loons while they are there.
Kathy, you mentioned that a participant needs to visit the loons at least 3 times.
Yes.
But in reality, how many times are our participants going to these lakes on average?
My best guess is maybe 3 to 4 times a month. So if you invest in that boat or in that cottage and you're going to the lake, you're going to go there as many weekends as you can. So they could very well be with their loons every weekend from May through October, maybe a little bit less before summer, a little bit less after summer. Maybe they'll also have a couple weeks on the loon lake. So if they jot down on a notepad every day they see the loons and what they're doing, they have a lot of data that they can share with us.
It sounds like a really fun and easy program to participate in if you're in the area.
Oh, absolutely. Like, they're an easy bird to see. They're easy bird to identify. You usually need some kind of a watercraft, ideally, unless you're on a very small lake, but it can be any kind of watercraft, from an electric powered boat to a paddleboard to a kayak to a powerboat. I do recommend binoculars. Predominantly, as I mentioned before, July is a tough time to identify the chicks. When the chicks are really little, they're little fuzzballs, and they're very at risk to getting too cold when they're in the water. So they're often carried on the back of the adults. And that is the most difficult time, because if you don't time it right, they're also the most vulnerable. So if you're too late, you might miss a chick in the count. And if you're too early, they may not be there yet. And if they're on the back, they're harder to see. So you need the binoculars just to see if the chicks are on the back. Because we do recommend you not to get too close. Stay at least 100 feet, 30 meters away from the adults at any given time.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense. And a lot of people have really top-notch cameras these days too. So I imagine you could use those to get a good look.
And binoculars are very much part of the boating culture as well as the birding culture. My own experience was with marine binoculars as a boating, being raised by a boating family long before I picked up binoculars to identify a bird.
That makes sense. Yeah, like I grew up with a hunting family, and so we were always looking for, there was always a scope in the back of the truck to look out and scan the horizon and see what kind of wildlife there was. So it was really cool that people grow up with these kinds of tools and they can put them to use with this program.
And the other cool thing about this, it doesn't have to be one person in the family. Like if you're having a tough summer, you call the neighbors and you say, listen, whatever our loon's doing, I haven't gotten to the lake. Or you can have the whole family, a lot of cottage and camps, families split up weekends on it. One half of the family may be there for the first 2 weeks, the other half for the second 2 weeks. They can all jot down the information on a piece of paper on the wall or on a calendar and share it afterwards. So it's a nice feature in the fact you don't have to be highly skilled at bird ID, and the whole traditional family can get into it. And I know that a lot of grandparents have loved introducing their children through wildlife, through loons.
I love that this can be a cottage emergency. Hey, Bob. Can you look at the loons for me? I cannot make it to the cottage this weekend.
Oh, just think if you're on the Facebook group. Like a lot of lakes and cottages have their own Facebook group. If you could easily set it up so people can talk to each other and work it through a Google Map system and just plunk dots on a Google Map, there's a real risk of getting too much information from your neighbors and then you have to figure it out. But it's a great way to get communication going on the cottage and things like that, especially when you think of today, how we've grown up to be a group of people that don't tend to talk to our neighbors, and especially during COVID. So it's a great way of introducing yourself to your lake community and getting to know your neighbors.
How exactly would someone join the Canadian Lake Loon Survey if they wanted to?
Well, they go to the website, and I would recommend they pull up the position description. It's right on the main website. And just review it and make sure that that matches their life and their schedule, and that this will work and be a good fit for them and their family. And if it is, there's a big button called the volunteer portal. Click on that and sign up, and you're
easy,
in.
Yep. Easy.
And
that's awesome.
We send you all the training materials you need, and then you can just enjoy the lake, and we'll even do the data entry for you at the end of the summer, because we're finding about half of volunteers do not want to open the computer at the lake, and I can't blame them.
In case you were wondering, that website is birdscanada.org/loons. Now back to Andrew.
What would you say are like the top 6 ways to help loons?
Biggest one is be careful on the waterways. Make sure that you slow down near loons. Make sure you steer clear of them. A new one that we're discovering is wake boats can have a great impact on the shoreline. So we're asking that wake boat users stay in the middle of the lake and in the deeper waters where they have the lesser impact. Watch how you handle your pollution. That's been a major issue publicly in the last few years, and it should be. You want to make sure your litter is going back and recycled or disposed of correctly and not ending up in the lake. Tackle is also a concern. It's hard to find lead-free tackle. It's hard to identify it, but we know for sure that tackle in loons will cause their death. So trying to make sure you're using lead-free tackle is important. Like, as I mentioned, make sure your shoreline's vegetated at the lake. Make sure you're not adding pollution to the lake. You can also support government actions towards climate change and pollution control. Also, last but far from least, become involved with citizen science on your lake. Loon Survey, of course, because we love to have volunteers working with us, but there's other options on your lake as well. So look up birdscanada.org/loons or contact your lake association if there's other opportunities you want to take on.
This is the one thing I've learned from this episode, Kathy, and this story, that loons are like the original cottage owners of these lakes, and that we all love this beautiful and now contested spaces and need to find a way for us to keep on enjoying it together.
Oh, yes. Like, we certainly don't want to lose such a beautiful common species. We certainly don't want our lakes to decrease in quality for so many reasons, not only for the recreational, emotional values associated with that lake, but for the health of our food and water supplies. We want to keep our fresh waters healthy. So I think if we're working to protect species, we're also working to protect our recreational environment and the health of people.
And despite their population decline over the years, is there something that maybe gives you hope for the loons?
The people always give me hope for the loons. I am a firm believer in grassroots activism, and the Loon Survey participants work so hard to try to do what's right for loons and for other wildlife and water quality on their lakes. It's phenomenal, and they've impressed me year after year since I began with this program, and they continue to impress me. I regularly get calls, what else can I do? How can my lake association make this better? So as long as we have all these people fighting for lakes and for loons, I think there's hope.
Kathy, is there a remarkable story you can remember from one of your participants?
I remember I was pretty new to the program, talking to a gentleman who was quite concerned because of low flyovers of helicopters, of all things, during military training on his lake. Loons communicate vocally, and they also can disturb easily beginning early in the season if they get a lot of noise and changes from the normality on the lake. So if everything stays the same, they're content. But it can disrupt the breeding population if there's a change. So he was very concerned because there was supposed to start military training on the lake. And he managed to contact his political powers, his MP and his MPP, and the military, and had the timing of the military training change to have less impact on the breeding season for birds on his lake. And I thought it was a true example of how a single person can use science and knowledge and politics to contact the right people and have a reasonable change that helps a species while at the same time not ensuring the opportunity for training is lost. And I see little things like that. I've seen several of them over the years, but that's as good of an example as any.
The Warblers is produced by Andres Jimenez, Jordi Allaire, Ruth Friendship Keller, Andrea Grass, and Kate Dolglish. This episode was edited by Katie Zhang, with theme music by Jose Mora, and artwork by Alexander Nickel. Until next time, keep birding.